This is Angle of View. Today is May 26th, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. It's Angle of View Classics Week 5 and our second director profile episode. We're going to be taking off from our David Fincher episode 2 weeks ago to burrow a layer deeper into this country's soil and look at one of the big shots of the U.S. indie wave of the 80s and 90s, Jim Jarmusch. It's hard to call Jarmusch a direct influence on Fincher. They trade in totally different kinds of coldness. Nor can it be said that Jarmusch paved the way for Fincher or anything like that, as Fincher came out of music videos and TV commercials, the way so many big movie directors of the 90s and 2000s did, while Jarmusch is a stalwart independent who has always worked outside the system. There's no linkage, really. Fincher is one of the very few directors who can rightly be called second-generation New Hollywood. He worshipped Hitchcock and Scorsese and Stanley Kubrick, and what he had to offer was the purely technical side of those titans' talents, which was perfect for a Hollywood in which technical ability was increasingly becoming the only currency for a director. Jarmusch, the most Gen X-coded boomer of all time, came up about 10 years earlier, when Hollywood was getting newly stiff and conservative, and never even attempted to participate in it. He loved European and Japanese directors and wanted to try to capture America through those kinds of outsiders' eyes, which is why his earliest movies all take place in mythic American cities, New York, New Orleans, Memphis, and all contain at least one foreign character. And he knew that the kinds of slow, dryly funny character studies that he wanted to make never had a snowball's chance in hell of getting financed in a Hollywood in which the adventurous 70s were so thoroughly over. By the time he was working, the studios were all being absorbed by risk-averse multinational corporations, movie deals were being struck increasingly on the basis of future TV viewership projections, and broader Reagan-era retrograde politics and the cultural rot that goes with them had made audiences newly disapproving of sex, violence, and engagement with major contemporary themes. Fincher worked the system from within and adapted to its needs, and his ultimate triumph is that once he had made it to the top, by which time that 80s stiffness in the culture had relaxed again a little, he made a few movies that were so good that they made the whole system look better. Jarmusch is not that. He's an auteur and an oddball, one of the few American artists in movies who has marched to his own drummer the whole time. So concludes my effort to connect these two. I enjoyed reviewing Jarmusch's most recent movie, Father, Mother, Sister, Brother, in full on these airwaves at the top of this year, and gave myself the chance to say a few general things about his work and career. But apart from that, and the paragraph I just finished reading, I've never talked about him, even though I've seen every single one of his movies and consider him an essential artist in the medium. Unfortunately, at least for me, I don't have the time at the moment to be taking stock of him or any of these featured artists and writing anything zoomed out and biographical about them to tie any kind of nice ribbon around my reviews of the individual movies. If I had that kind of time, I wouldn't need to be doing Angle of View classics in the first place. But maybe we can have fun with that absence, and that it leaves you with just my reviews of the movies in isolation and puts you in a position to draw whatever larger patterns you care to draw on your own. Maybe you will see thematic connections that I can't. Have fun. Here are my reviews of almost every Jim Jarmusch movie, in reverse chronological order, so that the worst one can be gotten out of the way quickly. Although, irony alert, this very bad movie that we're starting with is actually the one I went longest on, so it will take a little while to get it out of the way. If you were to read it on its own, it might make you think I hate this filmmaker. The rest of the reviews on this broadcast will hopefully confirm that I do not. The Dead Don't Die, 2019. Review date March 8, 2020. First and only viewing. A flailing, flopping attempt by Jim Jarmusch to do a super-duper, self-aware, postmodern, second-order, thinking person's elevated meta-riff on the zombie genre. In other words, a zombie movie by and for people who think they are too smart for zombie movies. Every frame sneers at the whole genre with contempt, and the movie has no animating spirit apart from this. It is the worst zombie movie ever made. I have defended Jim Jarmusch before against these kinds of accusations, but he is on another level here, so indefensibly high on his own farts that he thinks he can get away not only with Spaceballs-esque metaleptical stunts, in which the characters refer openly to the script, or to the theme song, or to Jim, but with cutely promising the audience a bad ending early on, and then acting like that makes the bad ending taste any better when it arrives. When adaptation tried that trick, it did it because the choice reinforced the central game of the movie, because it was a movie about conventions in movie screenplays, and it still didn't completely get away with it. When this movie does it, it's for a much cheaper reason, because Jarmusch refuses to do any hard work. He believes the only way he can package the point he wants to make is in the form of a big, dumb, climactic sermon. First of all, it isn't. But second of all, if you're going to go that route, you ought to commit to it. And nobody has ever committed less to anything than Jim Jarmusch committed to the end of this movie. The whole attitude of this third act breaks down like this. Because Jim is a very smart director, he is allowed to do big, dumb things as long as he assures you that he knows they're big and dumb while he's doing them. So when it looks like he's indulging in hack movie conventions, don't worry, he's not actually doing that. It's more like, wouldn't it be funny if he did do that? Which he never would, but if he did, it might look something like this? I cannot overstate the extent to which a bog-standard dime-a-dozen zombie movie is more enjoyable than this kind of snide superior commentary. At least that kind of movie might have a heart beating in its chest. You realize at the end that the only reason he'd been sledgehammering the fourth wall this whole time was to be able to smuggle that concluding monologue through. And what is that point at the heart of that monologue? Now that the very smart artist has assured you that he doesn't really mean anything he's saying, what is it that he has to say? The same thing that George Romero said 41 years earlier in Dawn of the Dead, and that hundreds of other zombie movies have repeated since, that because of dehumanizing cultural forces, people are zombies already. Pathetic as it is to circle back around to that tired lecture for the umpteenth time, the vehicle is even sadder than the tenor in this instance. Jarmusch really seems to think that just because the only way he could think to drive that lesson home was in the form of a sermon, that's the only way it could have been done. After all, if there were a smarter way, surely he would have thought of it. He seems to forget that Romero did it with gruesome situational humor, and that was the whole reason it connected. Frederick Elms, once a great enough cinematographer to shoot Blue Velvet, makes a complete mess of the exteriors, up to and including the cemetery scenes in which he dials in some of the worst-looking day-for-night shots in recent memory. It's shockingly ugly. Patterson, 2016. Review date February 27th, 2026. First and only viewing. Jarmusch's sweetest and most earnest movie by a mile, even if it's a studied sweet earnestness, because all his films are studied, because he's got that restless intelligence that compels him to watch himself. The self-consciousness it radiates is what keeps it from inhabiting the utterly surrendered worship of smallness that it's gesturing toward, but it still gets very far by playing up the mischievous end of the self-consciousness. After all, humor is where Jarmusch has always been sharpest. The winks that come bundled with all the doublings in the movie, the main character is a bus driver and poet named Patterson who drives a bus in Patterson, New Jersey, and the bus driver is played by Adam Driver, make for the clearest thread of this mischief. But there are some isolated moments that are little picayune classics, like Method Man in the laundromat and the Moonrise Kingdom kids on the bus. But the thing is, the few moments that seem actually torn from life are still the best in it, which include not only the scenes of the poems taking shape, but other moments of piercing truth, like, "I don't like you, Marvin." And I don't know if I've ever seen a subtler take on the comedy classic, "Kind person gratefully chokes down bad meal because it was prepared by someone they love," yet I was fully lolling at how Driver was pounding that water. That's the really relaxed stuff in the movie, and it's what shows that Jarmusch is actually capable of dialing in that frequency. He just doesn't trust himself to stay in it. Granted, there's some mischief in Patterson's poems themselves, and they are actually pretty good poems, which is often too much to ask for in movies about poets. But the best thing in them is how unpretentious they are. Jarmusch could have taken more leaves out of his main character's book. The real nagging pebble in the shoe that keeps me from falling all the way in is Laura, Patterson's wife, whose sweetness is inseparable from her child mind. I genuinely don't know what Jarmusch was going for with her, whether he's idealizing her or ridiculing her, but she's not nearly as close to being a real person as Patterson is, so it can't be good. Only Lovers Left Alive, 2013. Review date January 18th, 2026. First and only viewing. probably because I watched his execrable zombie movie first. I had every expectation of Jim Jarmusch's vampire movie being a similarly tiresome patchwork of discursive games. But while it isn't completely innocent of that, the movie actually has characters and a story of some definition. Who knew? I grow immensely weary of vampires as junkies, but at least the Sam Fuller headcam livens up the representation a little. Plus, the fangs coming out as vestigial has an odd charm and cuteness that Jarmusch uses extremely well as a setup to his Return of the Repressed ending. Speaking of psychopolitics, the choice to set most of it in Detroit and thread in some aches and pains about the decay of the American city, and then to shift it to Tangier and play with post-colonial anxieties about new ways of being sucked dry, should not have worked, especially since it didn't choose one or the other of those cards, but played both. But Jarmusch mostly lets all that be part of the room tone, rather than getting pedagogical with it. Even the scene in the theater with Adam's little mini-lecture about the death of the arts in a once-splendid American city is firmly enough anchored in the two characters as we have come to know them that it doesn't feel out of the flow of the story. It's also congruent with the fact that our heroes are old-world aristocrats who continue to live outside society, but have retained control amid the takeover of capital by their unbroken access to huge wads of cash. Vampires as junkies might be played out, but vampires as aristocrats always makes good social sparks. Their aloofness and foppishness play right into it. And Jarmusch uses it to give the ending an extra color. We see wealth resort to outright vicious predation the instant it becomes clear that its gentler exploitation routines can't go on as they have. And for a black comic interlude at the halfway point, Ava shows up to answer the question, can a vampire have histrionic personality disorder? The Limits of Control, 2009. Review date February 11th, 2026. First and only viewing. It's honestly a cool idea to smash a hitman-slash-spy movie and a head-trip quest-for-self movie together. I don't know if anyone else has ever noticed that the two iconographies live so close to one another, but head trips, very much including dreams, frequently involve mysterious strangers, cryptic messages, and recurring symbols, so why not? For Jarmusch to have been the one to fire up this blender makes a very plain kind of sense. He loves to play around on the surfaces of themes, to make provocative suggestions and then back away. For a movie that deliberately putts around in circles and almost never raises its pitch, it's bizarrely compelling. Isaac de Boncolet's face is enough of an anchor. Coffee and Cigarettes, 2003. Review date February 23rd, 2026. First and only viewing. I see this as Jarmusch taking the piss out of himself for the first time, i.e. acknowledging that he has a thing and watching us watch him do that thing and hanging the quotation marks around it himself. The episodic format and deliberate focus on mannered petty dialogues and general lightness of weight make this all the easier to detect, but it's still frequently cute, even when the bits are go-nowhere duds. Shrouded in this new self-awareness, that kind of stasis, as in the vignette called No Problem with Alex Descartes and Isaac de Boncolet, becomes much more arch. Highlights include pretty much all of the Roberto Benigni-Stephen Wright one, pretty much all of the Lee siblings and Steve Buscemi one, the Tom Waits joke about him being a doctor, the way we return to that joke with RZA, the reveal that Bill Murray is playing himself and the way RZA and GZA keep calling him by name, the way the Mahler breaks in on the Taylor Mead Bill Rice one, appropriately enough at the end, and the weirdly sexy way Kate Blanchett says, "Oh, squirrel." Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai, 1999. Review date February 28th, 2025. First and only viewing. However great Forrest Whitaker always is, there is only so much to get excited about here. I think my long wait to watch this, for which nobody is to blame but me, got my hopes up. Jarmusch doesn't offer much more of himself to this material than a self-absorbed delight in the basic originality and obvious strangeness of it. It kind of feels like the movie the main character would have made about himself, so sincere and direct is he, and yet it's nowhere near as enjoyable as he is. What falters is the tone Jarmusch brings to mob themes and characters, which tries to integrate comic, dramatic, and action energies but is unsure of the mixture. When he treats the mundane this way, it's always disarmingly funny, but when applied to high-temperature situations, the result is something that feels like it's happening in less than three dimensions. Also not helping matters is that the movie's central idea, that life gains purpose when you live by a code, even slash especially in a world where codes have been reduced to fashions, feels comforting and energizing as you start to hook onto it, but every successive scene drags it more and more to the surface. By the end, everybody's saying it out loud. Plus, John Tormey is inert, and his crucial scenes with Whittaker just don't dance. The scenes of Whittaker with Isaac de Boncole and with Camille Winbush are all great. So great that they're responsible for 90% of my fond rating. And a movie that gave us more of them interacting and less of this confused mob genre material, which it never takes past the level of footsie, would have been a lot more satisfying. Dead Man, 1996. Review date February 9th, 2026. First and only viewing. Jim Jarmusch's El Topo, only the soul being purified through violence looks to be more the son's than the father's. Its tone is caught between the mythic and the mundane, but of course this is exactly the point. And even if the American West as death's anteroom thing doesn't resonate with quite the force we might like, not least because the film denies the West its beauty, which I think would have made the equation more interesting, it's still Jarmusch's most ambitious film, and his only attempt to push his laconic and typically urban style of dialogue all the way into the lyrical, which is just the way to admit it to the Old West. It makes sense as a direction for this artist to have stretched in. Besides the theme being a bit thin, some of the other abandoned standards of more traditional drama are missed, like a well-formed main character. But the movie's orientation is committed to this other abstract thing, and it is consistent enough in this to stay involving, even if it's not exactly perky. The quasi-theatrical trappings are interesting, quite a few sets and props, not a lot of big landscape, and the violence is effective, always binding to the humor just enough to make it queasier, and sort of innately funny given that everyone is kind of a ghost to begin with, so that the deaths that we actually see are second go-rounds. Other strengths, impeccable casting, up to and very much including Iggy Pop in 19th century frontier drag, a surreally artificial look from Robbie Muller, cinematographer, that oddly prefigures digital black and white, but assists the abstractness and theatricality of the conception, and a deservedly celebrated guitar score from Neil Young, which arranges its limited pool of themes to make a fever dream. Mystery Train, 1989. Review date February 7th, 2026. First and only viewing. Unaccountably wonderful in that way typical of early Jarmusch, somehow comforting in spite of itself. Jarmusch is one of the few who could indulge this gimmick of orienting a movie around a place and delighting in the chance of paths crossing there without putting on airs. There's no corny, trumped-up magic about the encounters and near misses. Everything that is arresting in it earns this quality by the tone being steered in the opposite direction, towards smallness. E.g., it's still a dingy flophouse, even though it's Screamin' Jay Hawkins working the front desk. But seriously, how amazing is Screamin' Jay Hawkins, though? Next question, are you surprised? The place, i.e. Memphis, the larger place, does take on temporary momentousness when viewed through the eyes of strangers, especially visitors from outside the U.S., but the real comedy is in the comedown, which always follows before long. What's most remarkable is the way you are made to realize that nothing has actually changed size. Jarmusch keeps the style so collared that the thrills and horrors are purely a product of your investment in the characters, and you feel the delusional quality of perception. Closing on a trio of local yokels drives this smallness home. Even the murder they commit seems small. They're not really worried about it anymore once they get inside their room, and neither are you. Footnote, the English guy counts as a local. He's been assimilated. Though as with Screamin' Jay, we get a layer cake of pleasure from recognizing Joe Strummer, with his rockabilly style of those days turned up only by about 20%, just enough for him to get compared to Elvis and resent it. Down by Law, 1986. Review date May 17th, 2026. Second viewing. Pretty cute to use a jailhouse setting to cook up such a tame little confection. It takes three utterly innocent and blameless inmates, for starters. But it's very well made for something so shallow and simple. It's a personality showcase, and while John Lurie can't get an inch off the ground as a pimp, Tom Waits and Roberto Benigni more than make up the difference. Small wonder that they both became major screen presences, in their own ways, in later years. It doesn't take deadpan to the sublime place that Stranger Than Paradise found, but it does have its own enchantments. The quiet New Orleans night scenes, the stuff in the cell block that goes unseen, and Benigni's verbal gags. Once you get past the lumpy first act, every scene is at least pleasant. Stranger Than Paradise, 1984. Review date, May 17th, 2026. Third or fourth viewing. As long as they don't seem genuinely miserable, and they're not making other people miserable, it can be extremely funny to watch people just sitting around. Not because it makes one feel superior, but on the contrary, because the impulse to sit around, especially when it feels too risky to get excited about things, is so universal. My life looked a great deal like this for most of my 20s, and I didn't look anywhere near this cool living it. Jarmusch finds real social resonance and also, much harder, tender sweetness in this little petri dish of armored attitudes without introducing a single particle of condescension. It remains his best movie. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.